Register things, reel 10.
Yes, I said to him, how can you expect the British government to stand by you when you've gone and assassinated a lot of people? I said, if Aung San and his men and his party were hosted in a much less murderous fashion than the way you carried it out, then there might have been some hope for you to be called upon to form the government. He said, well, I'll tell you this. I preempted a strike by Aung San against the existing British administration. I said, what do you mean? He said he was planning a military coup. I said, against whom? He said, well, the British government to start off with, the governor. The plan was that he was going to surround Government House, kidnap the government. I said, well, why should he do that? He said, well, he's had no assurances yet that he didn't have any assurances then that Burma was going to get independence. And I said, he went to England. He was assured by Attlee that the date of the independence was his time of choosing. And I believe that, I said, as it turned out, it was going to be the following year, sometime in January, very early. He didn't have to do all these things. He said, well, you see, the British have always had a reputation of being very clever and very prone to breaking their promises. And I said, well, I don't see that at all. He said, well, as I say, you're a youngster, you don't know. He said, this is politics. He said, these things do happen. And he said he wasn't very convinced. I'm sure he wasn't very convinced the British were going to grant him independence. I mean, he was leading up to this sort of thing. Hence, all these private army men, you know, many of these private army floating around in Rangoon, did what they like in the face of the administration. He said he had them at his house in on the Royal Lake, you know, all over the place. People dared go by the house at night because they fired on them. And he said, I told him about the two attempts on my life, and he said, well, what was the PVO. I said, why? He said, well, at that stage, you were being suspected of complicity with the British Army, having engineered this whole thing. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I got all the weapons through British Army officers. I got all the ammunition through British Army officers. He did admit that he had got Vivian, who was an Army officer attached to the police arms depot, to get these arms. And I said, what was his interest in it? He said, purely money. He said, he's a mustard, you know. I said, did you pay him money? He said, oh, yes, a lot of money. I said, well, he got you 44 Brens, 44 Stens. He said, yes, but he promised to get me much more till this thing blew up. He said, I got to the stage when I really got worked up, and I thought, well, I've got to do something now or never. He said, the only thing I didn't believe that anybody would associate me with this assassination. I said, look, your bungalow was wide open. We had it watched. Surely you would have known that we'd have somebody on the lake watching what the hell was going on in your bungalow. You get army trucks coming. You get army officers visiting. He said, well, that's not unusual. They could have coming on other business. I said, no. Then these barrels get immersed in the water. I said, you mean to say that you thought that nobody would have seen what was going on? He said, well, I was given an assurance that no matter what was seen, that there would be no connection between me and anything that would have transpired subsequently. I said, no, you must be crazy. I said, the army might have been on your side, the governor might have been on your side, but you had police officers like myself and Jupp and Tunal to contend with. It was our job to see what the devil was going on. I mean, after all, we were responsible for the security of the cabinet and people in the government in Rangoon. The army, of course, had nothing to do with it. they would have come in at the worst. And in fact, they didn't, actually, because the state of emergency was declared, and between the governor, Tunlaram, and the army commander, it was reckoned they brought a battalion of British troops down to Wimbledon. I think it was the Gloucesters, and that was supposed to be sufficient for internal security duties. The rest, I think, Rees, Tunlaram, assured the government that we could handle ourselves. I think that it was a bit of wishful thinking, because had the PVO really gone to town, having had their leader and master assassinated, they could have created real havoc and we wouldn't have been able to handle the situation. As it was, all the time that I was going around to ministers, they were calling me and saying that they'd seen some suspicious characters around the house. Would I come around or I should go around and show them? I hardly slept. I was all over the place. He said, well, yeah, all I can say is that anybody tries to do something to me, I'll do a proper job when I do it. And that's as much as he told me. I'll give him his due. When he was hanged, he went to the scaffold, no cap, no top, no nothing. He just took it. He didn't shout slogans. He was talked quietly. Some of the others we had trouble with too, and they were dragged screaming to the scaffold. Two chaps of his, they went the same way. They had the old cap put on them, and they went. And I still wonder, you know, why he didn't want to tell me who he suspected. But you see, the unrest that followed and the fear of the PVO was that they were quite convinced that the British government was behind it. And subsequent books that have been written about the assassination have all suggested and pointed to that suspicion that the Burmese had, and a lot of other people had who were then in Burma at the time. But there again, too, there was so much speculation at the time. Naturally, the Burmese, and this could apply to any other race, when you have a sort of a colonial power that was in charge at the particular time of a serious incident like that, they always are led to believe that there's the British involvement in it. In fact, there was a lot of red herrings there. People who, an army brigadier, British army brigadier, was seen to go away from the secretary minutes before the assassination took place. I'm quite convinced that he had nothing to do with it, but of course, when you have that sort of thing, people do speculate. And I think that even to this very day, those that remember Aung San's death, and who may be still alive now in their 70s, still believe that there was some conspiracy there which encouraged Dussault to take over and that things went wrong. Or that there was a plan to assassinate Aung San and then for them to take over, but things went wrong in the end. And I think we acted too quickly.
Who acted too quickly?
We, the Burma police, acted too quickly. I think Tunlaram was pressing for the Dussault's bungalow to be searched and Dussault to be arrested if there was sufficient evidence to warrant an arrest. I think that if things went the way that whoever wanted to
go that way,
I mean, it was the government house who delayed the raid on the house. I think they anticipated that it would take us 2 or 3 days before we raided Dussault's house, in which time he would be able to move off to Tharavadi district with all his weapons and what have you. One of the things that Dussault said to me, I said, now why were those lads who were, I found in the back room, drunk? He said, no, I dumped them. I was going to murder them. He said, you do away with the evidence, sir. But he said, you came and you found them. I said, well, everything you delayed. And he said, there was no cause for me to rush. At least, I thought so then. But he said, in hindsight now, I should have moved off as soon as they arrived. But he said, you see, there was that fear that I couldn't trust them as well. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, supposing I'd said, right, into the trucks, into the vans, we're off to Thalawadi. Who knows that they might have assassinated me on the way? I said, I wouldn't have done that. He said, no, you've got to think of all these things. You cannot trust people. You're too young, my friend. You've got trust to people. He said, you cannot trust people. And he said, I had planned to kill them. Now, when we dug up the ground of his bungalow, we did find corpses, mainly of young girls who had been made pregnant. And we believed that Usman was very fond of young women. And I think there were three young girls of 17 or 18. Their corpses, had disintegrated. We found two men that had been buried there, and there were skeletons there, they were male skeletons. So perhaps, you know, in his own sweet time, he said they were heavily doped. So I said, what are you going to do with them? Are you going to shoot them or something? He said, no. He said, having had them doped, they were totally at my mercy. I'd have found ways and means of disposing of them. And I said, where are we going to dump them? And he said, well, you found corpses in the ground, didn't you? You never got any evidence to charge him for the murders of these people. You didn't know who had done them, you see. I got a lot of information. I was brought in at one stage before I went to the Arakan. Now, one of the lads who was there was a young Shan, and he's a very nice-looking boy, and he had a very nice-looking young wife. He couldn't have been more than, say, 20. His wife was about 18. Lovely couple. Now, he drove one of the vehicles to the secretariat. He wasn't in at the actual killing. And I, being young and probably convincing, turned around and said, I want you to work on that lad. I'm sure that he knows an awful lot that went on. I said, right. Now, he said, as an inducement, if he tells you what we want to know, he said, we want to know who left the house and who went to the secretariat. He said there were two jeeps, and we also know that there was a 1500 wheel as well. And we believe that Kilong Yin, this young Shan, drove the 1500 wheel. So you can work on him, you see. So we left him in the bungalow. We didn't arrest him. And he was there, of course, with the police milling around and what have you. He was being quite helpful. His wife was producing meals for the police who were there. There were some of these maid servants who were preparing food. We took over the bungalow completely. And I quietly worked on Kimong Yin. I used to take him for little strolls and what have you. And he then started to tell me times when they left. He said he wasn't privy to what was going to take place. And I said, well, surely you saw these chaps in the two jeeps, three men in one and two in the other. You saw them taking their weapons with them. He told me about the jeeps. Now, going back to the jeeps, when I first went into the bungalow on that rainy day, I think I mentioned that the paint on the jeeps looked very new. And when I finished coming out of the house, I went and touched the paint and it was still wet. They'd got these afterwards. Too long, Joe said to me, that the two jeeps had only arrived about a fortnight before the 19th. He'd got them from somewhere, and they were army colored, you know, green jeeps. And the numbers were, he said he didn't actually see the painting on them, so they might have painted. Because they had a bit of a shed and a garage at the back of the house near the entrance. And he said, I didn't see the jeeps after they were delivered. They seemed to have disappeared. And he said, now that when I think of it, they must have been in the large double garage near the entrance of the bungalow. And as I said, I felt the paint at the rear. The jeep has got two sort of small bumpers at the rear with a wheel and a petrol tank at the back. and then you've got a long bump in the front. And I just felt the paint and it was wet. They had put army colors, the Burma army colors, I think it was white, green, and red stripes to, in, you know, make them appear to be Burma army vehicles. But of course, the men that went into the secretariat were all dressed in, as Burma army soldiers, which didn't cause an awful lot of suspicions at the gate, because we questioned the policeman at the gate of the secretariat. It was manned. Said how, well, I didn't question them, but I heard. Now, when the police questioned these, were carrying out this investigation, they said, how did you let these two jeeps go through? And they said, look, his private army chaps are all dressed in army uniforms. They float around in jeeps. They came on and said, Aung San's bodyguards or something, we let them through. Now, that was another thing, because the police manned the gates. The suspicious one, the suspicion was that the Burma police were involved. How come, if it was so strict, they let these two army jeeps into the secretariat? So, Burma police involvement. You can't trust the police. Then I got involved, and I think it was because of their suspicions about me. I did go and see people in the army. They knew that I was an ex-army officer. I think the idea was, well, we're getting rid of this guy as well. Now, it caused, it wasn't outside, he was dead. I don't know who in that lot decided. I knew Bo Layar very well. Now, he was one of the heroes that went to Japan. I used to go to his house during that time at Windermere Park. He was a very nice chap. Thoroughly against the whole assassination. Nguyen was jumping up and down in Kumana, denouncing Aung San even after his death. He was on my arrest list. I thought, I remember telling Chan Tu Gao, you expect me to go and arrest this guy? He's got 1,000 soldiers under him there in Kumana. Well, he said, do your best. So I said, well, if you leave it to me, I rang him up because I knew him. And his second in command was Johnny Robertson, a friend of mine. And I said, got Nguyen on the phone and said, look, I've got you on my arrest list. I know you're not involved at all, but I said, this is a farce here. There's so many people that I've got on my list that have nothing to do with it, but these are the orders that have come down. He said, from who? And I said, I really don't know. One must assume it's come down from the Prime Minister who knew or who's advising him. So I said, look, you are well known. I'm coming up to Pigu. I was conveying another arrested minister. I was going to dump him in Tongu jail. I was also going to see my wife then. She hadn't come down. I was going to spend the weekend. I said, look, come down. Meet me at Tongu. And I gave him a meeting point. I said, don't come down with the whole battalion behind you because it's going to cause trouble. Just come down with an escort, a driver, a bodyguard or something. And I'll meet you in Tongu. And we met, and I said, look, go down to Rangoon and sort this out. I don't believe for a minute that you're involved at all. You might have been a great criticized Aung San an awful lot, but you couldn't have been there. You're miles away. Okay, thanks very much. He was terrified when he saw me. And I said, well, for the purposes of the exercise, I've arrested you and released you on bail. All right? On your own. Off you go. He went down. I think he was always grateful to me after that for taking that. I said to Chan Tu Long, I said, there's no way I can arrest him. And he said, he said, on that score, there was a bit of comment that you were sort of, carrying out orders as you liked. I said, yeah, but then give him some sort of discretion, for God's sake. I said, there's U Ba, a retired peace officer. He's 82 years old. He can hardly see. What do I do with a man like that? I can't block him, arrest him, and put him in a jail. I said, I went to see him, apologized to him, and said, as far as I'm concerned, you're under arrest. I've granted you bail, and you'll make yourself available if you ever want to. And as I can tell you that of that list of 400, there are nearly 250 that I've done the same thing to. It's totally ridiculous. How can you get involved like that? I said, I've been used for political purposes. For what? And he kept telling me, oh, don't argue, Carlyle, but he said, do carry out orders. He said, no, I believe in the British way of doing things. He said, this is the Burmese way. And I said, well, get a Burmese officer then. He can carry out your government's instructions. I'm certainly not going to do anything like that. I think afterwards he didn't mind me. He said, you're a stubborn fellow. And when Jupp then left, because he was then being accused of involvement in the murders and all sorts of things, there were a whole lot of allegations. I was then given the job of conducting the total investigation. I was getting all the reports collated and what have you, and then writing out briefs for the Attorney General, spending a lot of time. And every time I saw him with a brief and proposals for a future course of action, he said, don't waste your time with all this rubbish. They're all going to get hanged. I said, how do you mean all going to get hanged? They've got to be tried. The evidence has got to be produced against them. You have to have all this information. Don't worry, my friend, he said. Don't waste your time. Go and enjoy yourself. Don't bother about all this writing. He said, they're doomed, they said. I said, well, that's Burmese justice again. He said, yeah, we know that Burmese did it. I said, yes, but then the question of Unsoh's complicity. Now, he is an accessory after the fact. Because in those days, we had an accessory before, an accessory after. I said, right, we can prove a conspiracy. Because we've got Yang Kim Ong-in, who eventually turned King's evidence. He got 7 years. He wasn't topped. I said, yeah, we can prove conspiracy. We just have to prove conspiracy to murder, and then anybody associated with the actual assassination was an accessory before, an accessory after the fact. The very first time British law changed was the Bentley Craig shooting, when Bentley was done as the adult, and he was hanged as an accomplice in the first degree then, you see. And prior to that, it was very difficult. And I said, we can prove conspiracy, but he wasn't actually at the shooting. And he said, oh, well, he harbored them, you see. It was he who initiated the whole thing. I said, oh, well, fair enough, then. If you believe that that is the way, yeah, you're a much more, you've got far more experience of the law than I have. But he said, don't waste your time. Don't waste your time. Then when I told him I'd been promoted, he said, I know. So I was a party to your promotion. Don't worry, you go up in the Arakan there on this lovely island and enjoy yourself. When we need you, we'll call you down. In that time, when I went to Rambi Island, I was in Rangoon twice because my wife was still left in the CID house.
Well, I went on my own.
I came down, and then on other two occasions I came down when Tumang wanted me, and then I had a word with Chandua who wanted to see me. And there was no indication that I wasn't going to be called at the trial, but I wasn't. I think it was, they took it, and it was, when I asked Chantra afterwards, I said, I thought that I would have been brought in to say exactly what had happened when I arrested him. He said, well, in fact, you weren't the arresting officer, Jupp was the arresting officer. You were the first to break into the bungalow and to warn him to stay where he was. He said, that's not relevant. And I said, I heard Jupp say, you are under arrest. He said, well, that's a formality. If we don't believe that his lawyers are going to contest that at all, they'll agree that he was arrested by Mr. Jupp, who's now no longer in this country. He said, the rest, of course, you didn't unearth all the brains from the lake, you know. So he said, no worry at all. So then we go on to my police career. 1948, I'm in Chowkyu on Rami Island. 1949, the Inspector General of Police, who is then Tun Lahaung, my mentor, decides that the DSP, we're known as District Superintendents of Police, not Chief Police Officers. The DSP, a chap called Noor Mangji, who had a very forceful district commissioner, a chap called George Rawlings, who was suspected of all sorts of acts of bribery in his career. He even had a very colourful career, but I think they never got George to court because they could never prove anything. It was being dominated. This fellow Noel Lounge was a bit of a weak policeman, being dominated by this chap John Rory. And he said, right, now that I went, that was at Akyab. Now, we had such different grades of stations. I was at Chowpew, which is known as a second class station.
This is the Arakan.
Arakan, yeah. There were three districts here in the Arakan. Akyab to the north, Chowpew on Rami Island to the south, in the middle, and then down south was Sandaway on the mainland. Akyab was a first class station. It meant my promotion when I took over Akyab onto the selection grade. They had this funny sort of selection grade of the Burma police. That is, you got a higher salary than the ordinary DSP. Well, Noel Bungie got a higher salary than I did when I was on Chowpew, but when I replaced him, I went on to a higher selection grade salary scale, you see. He said, you can sort out Lawrence much better than this guy. He's weak. So poor old Noel replaced me. He went to Chowpew. 1949, all of a sudden, of course, there's total unrest there. As my wife was telling you, the insurgents, who were Arakanese on the one side, who disliked the Burmese. Arakan was a completely separate entity. It could have been a totally different country because you had a mountain range, the Arakan Yomas, separating the Arakan Strip from Burma. It went right down south. There was very little the Burma government could do. There was no way of, say, trying to suppress a takeover in that territory because they would have had to climb mountains to get to these people. There was no question of doing a seaborne landing because there were the areas were not conducive to that sort of an operation. As for coming in by air, well, there was a strip in Chowpew, a strip in Sandaway, a strip in Akyab. So anyway, I was brought in. In 1949, I was able to contain the insurgents in the Akyab district. And they were taking over whole towns and raiding treasuries and raiding the armories there and sort of disbanding the police.
These were Arakanese nationalists?
Yes. They were communists. And the head of whom was an old university friend of mine, a chap called Marutu. And when I came up to the Arakan, when I heard that he was in charge, he lived in the jungles at a place west of a town called Pongrajun. And I went to, I sent him a message saying that I'd taken over at Akyab. I said, I wanted to see him to discuss ways and means of trying to stop this nonsense that was going on because they were ambushing passenger launches and killing people. They were killing government officials, doing all sorts of things.